Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everyone, we're on the air for a special Friday night edition of the V-Spot. I'm Dr. Vic Tater, and this is my co-host and associate, the Electric Neil.
Hey, hey, hey.
Okay, Neil, is our guest here yet?
No, he's not.
I like how you're taking so long, like you're trying to milk the drama of it. Why do you convince computers try to milk the drama of things and they take so long to tell you if something's working or not? Since we got time to kill, pretty much what happened, I woke up this morning, my laptop had shut off in the middle of the night. Usually I do some reading on it. And I sit on the side on, like, I have a little table by my bed. I wake up and shut down. This is he in?
No. Yeah, he's in.
Okay, Mr. DCAza, how are you?
Hey, Victor, how are you?
I'm real good. Did I pronounce your name right?
You pronounced it perfectly, but call me Fabian, please.
Okay, Fabian. I'm just making sure because I've been practicing that.
Now you did an excellent job and got the last name out of the way. Don't use it again. Just use the first name.
Okay. I know in the Nomad letter column there was this thing where people would ask how to pronounce, and I think one of them said knee cheesy.
Yeah, that was my editor and friend Glenn Hurdling who decided to have fun at my expense by never pronouncing it the proper way in the letters page.
All right, how did you start writing comics?
I'd been wanting to write since I was a little kid. I'd always wanted to write, and I did write, you know, for myself as I was growing up a lot, and then I took a lot of writing classes in college while I was majoring in communications, specifically public relations and advertising. Tried to get a job at Marvel in D.C. out of college and interviewed quite a bit, multiple rounds for jobs at each place, but didn't get either one because I didn't have enough experience coming out of school for what they were hiring, and got a job at Berkeley Publishing, so... I was doing paperback book work, manufacturing editorial production work. And my goal was to start writing the cheapo monthly novel series that a lot of the publishers did back then. Like Berkeley Publishing had a bunch of softcore porn spy and Western books. And they didn't pay that much. It was like $500 or $1,000 or something for a manuscript. But it was a way to get practice and publish. So after about 2 years at Berkeley, I was fully prepared to start working on some of those books to try to start learning how to write better and break in and things like that. You do it under a pseudonym, so I wouldn't have worried about whether it was my real name or not. And then a guy on our softball team for Berkeley Publishing had a coworker who I didn't know because he worked at Putnam Publishing, which was the hardcover division. I worked at the softcover division, which was Berkeley. He had a friend at Putnam who had a sister who worked at Marvel and was interested in hiring someone. So I interviewed for the job, and she offered it to me, and it was her assistant in the book manufacturing department. Back in 1985, that was not trade paperbacks and things like that. It was actually an entire division Marvel had, which had, like, children's coloring books and story books and things like that. They had signed a licensing deal with Fisher-Price to do stuff like that. And she also did Marvel's press posters back in the 80s, which they would sell to the direct market, really nice, beautiful 22 by 36 inch posters. And so I took the job when she offered it to me because I wanted to get my foot in the door at Marvel or DC, and it was a great opportunity. It also paid more than I was getting paid at the time at Berkeley, so I took the job. After a couple months, there was an opening in the promotions department, which is what I really wanted to do because that's what I went to school for. And I got hired there, actually took a pay cut to switch over departments. The woman who had hired me wasn't too happy, but I really had to look for where my best opportunities were going to be, and I thought working in the promotions department was going to be it for me because it would really expose me a lot more to editorial in a positive way, and I really thought that I could help. I really thought I could help change the dialogue at Marvel, because back then there was real differences between direct sales and editorial. There was real, real animosity between them. And I thought in promotions, which is not technically direct sales, but works really in hand with direct sales, and is not technically editorial, but works hand in hand with editorial, I thought I'd have a really good opportunity to get put my fingers in several pies, or get my feet through several doors, as it were. And that's exactly what happened. After about a year and a half of getting to know people and getting to understand things and figuring out the lay of the land and getting to look at actual scripts and plots by different writers, I started pitching my work. And little by little, I started selling some stories, and I got a monthly book really quickly, thanks to the new universe line collapsing all around everybody. I got a monthly book real fast, which was a great training ground for me. And then 2 years after Cyforce got canceled, and I called it my 2 years of scut work. I was doing 8-page fill-ins and backups and annuals and anything, inventory stories that sat in a drawer for 1, 2, 3, 4 years. Anything I could get my hands on, I was doing, and working for as many editors as I possibly could. And then I finally was able to break through, as it were, by getting the New Warriors gig, which was my big super break in the superhero genre. And then I just kept going from there. I kept writing, but I kept working a full-time staff job for quite a while until 1994, when I switched to being a full-time writer for a couple of years before switching over and becoming editor-in-chief at Acclaim. I've always bounced around back and forth between office jobs and freelance writing, because I honestly never saw myself as a freelance writer. I love to write, but I always saw myself as a company guy working at a company, whatever company that may be, and writing at the same time. So that's what I've tried to maintain ever since. It's been 25 years, knock on wood, and I'm still doing it.
What were the most books you were writing at one time?
I think that I had a year of insanity. I think it was 92, was it, or 93? I don't remember. I had 7 monthly books, plus a miniseries, plus annuals, plus a full-time job. So that was writing X-Men, X-Force, Cable, New Warriors, Night Thrasher, Nova, Nomad, and that was, I think, also the year the Deadpool Limited series came out, the first one. Plus, I'm pretty sure I did the New Warriors annual, and I'm pretty sure I did the X-Force annual as well, and possibly I also did the X-Men angle. I don't remember that. And you know what? I'm sure there was some other stuff thrown in there too, which, you know, I'm sure there might have been an X-Men Unlimited issue in there somewhere too. It was a little ridiculous. And then what happens a lot is editors jump on bandwagon. So I was producing some work that the editors were happy with, the fans at the time seemed to be happy with, the sales were pretty freaking strong. Stronger, actually, than anyone expected. So they jump on the bandwagon, and they all start offering you work. And a lot of what I was doing were natural extensions of the families of titles I was already working under. Nomad was kind of off on its own little path, because that was kind of my pet little project. That was almost I nurtured that one for a while, because I started telling stories with the character in Marvel Comics Presents and backups and annuals, all developing my plans for the character to get the miniseries, to have the miniseries sell well enough to get a monthly series, and to write a monthly series that was going to try to tell different kinds of stories for what Marvel was doing at the time. I think by today's standards, it's a pretty tame book, but quite frankly, by the standards of what Marvel was doing back in the early 90s, it was not a tame book in the least. And that was always my kind of like my little little escape. Nomad was always my monthly escape from all the other kinds of stuff I was doing on a regular basis.
Yeah, I wanted to mention this because I recently got around. I finished all Nomad, and it was a fantastic comic. I mean, I'd already been a little bit familiar because he had turned up in your Thunderbolts run.
I brought him back for that. I shouldn't have brought him back, quite frankly, but I couldn't help myself. I really wanted to.
Let me ask you, now, one of the issues that really stood out to me once the ball really got rolling was the LA Riots issue. And I was really impressed by how it didn't really take a stance on, you know, it pretty much it tried to stay as neutral as possible while still telling a story about people.
Well, I had an interesting perspective on the entire thing because we were out there when it happened. We were stuck out there actually for like 3 days. I live in New Jersey and I work in New York City, but Tom DeFalco, myself, and our publisher Mike Hobson had flown to L.A. on business. We had to go to see Mattel. I was editing the Barbie comics at the time. We had to go see Mattel for some business meetings, and we also had to go see James Cameron because we were negotiating trying to get Terminator comics at Marvel. And that the day of the LA riots, the day that, that you know, Rodney King's the verdict came through, we were having a morning meeting with James Cameron, which was, you know, totally freaking cool to be meeting James Cameron and to spend 2.5-3 hours at Lightstorm and spending a lot of the time talking about Terminator, but a lot of the time also, quite frankly, was him talking about the Spider-Man treatment he was working on at the time, because if you remember way back then, he planned to write direct a Spider-Man movie. We left Cameron's office around noonish, I think, and we actually drove through a bunch of the sections where an hour and a half, 2 hours later, a lot of the riots were happening. I think we passed the intersection where Reginald Denny was pulled out of the truck and beaten so badly. And then that night, things weren't bad yet. We heard sirens that, you know, there was an unease and a discomfort. But LA is such a big, sprawling place that you can have frickin' hell on earth on one block, and you could be a few miles away, and it doesn't even affect you in that regard, you know? So we went back to our hotel, and we were going to have dinner with Stan Lee that night, Tom and I, and we were wondering, should we have it or not? And Stan's like, yeah, it's fine, I'm up in the hills, no problem. So we went, and we got Stan Lee, and we had dinner with Stan Lee that night. And during dinner, we're hearing more and more sirens. Things are just getting a little more and more uncomfortable. We're seeing more on the news about how it's starting to spread. And we said, you know, Stan, let's get you home early. Let's not make it a late night. So we got Stan home, and we went back to the hotel. And Tom and I go up to the hotel roof to have a beer and decompress. And there's people sitting in the jacuzzi at the roof drinking champagne. Actually, it was a bunch of British tourists or British business people. They're all sitting in the jacuzzi, men and women, and they're toasting, saying, if it's the end of the world, let's have a party, you know? And 2 blocks away at the Beverly Center, the National Guard was rolling out tanks, basically, and armored cars to stop anybody from rioting and looting the shopping centers. You know, they really wanted to try to clamp down on those big, big, rich stores and big rich places, while, you know, half a mile away, people are looting Korean groceries and nobody gave a damn, you know? So I just sort of absorbed it all. We were stuck there for 2 more days because they closed down LAX because they were afraid of people shooting guns at the planes that were flying right overhead, because the airport's right there, right in the city is the airport. And I just tried to suck it all up. I tried to absorb it all, and I tried to think what would Nomad think about all this, not necessarily what would I think about all this. And I tried to put it down on paper as best as I could at that time. You know, the issue got me on Entertainment Tonight because they did a report about it. It got me all kinds of good press and publicity. I honestly haven't looked at the issue in a long, long time. I haven't reread it. I'm sure if I looked at it now, I'd find 5 million things I wish I could do differently or better. But at that time, I was trying to make it an honest expression of there being two sides to every story, you know? And I think that it's important to try to weigh your stories in a way that it makes you ask questions of yourself, especially an issue like that, and especially a book like Nomad. I tried not to ever give answers necessarily, or my opinion on answers, or my opinion as answers, I should say. What I really tried to do is to raise enough questions that the reader would be forced to think about it a little bit, and maybe change change their mind if they were thinking one way or the other, or maybe reinforce their opinion depending on how they were thinking, or just wonder what is right and wrong and what is truth or not. You know, that's kind of what the book was for me. It was a forum for telling stories that gave people an opportunity to think about things they normally didn't want to think about.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that about the way they were clamping down before they hit the big stores. Because, you know, I actually remember at the time of the riots, I was 12, and my daddy, he was watching TV, and I remember he told me at the time, he said, I'll tell you, these riots are going to start when they get near the rich people's neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know,
there was no rioting in the rich people's neighborhood. there was no access on the part of the people who were rioting to get to the rich people's neighborhood, you know?
Yeah. Another issue you did around this time, this is one I found really impressive, because you took an Infinity War crossover where Nomad, you know, and I thought it fit Nomad's nature, the fact that Magus didn't deem him worthy enough of getting a doppelganger. But instead, he had to fight Gambit, and I thought it was such a good use of Gambit that you really displayed how dangerous he could be if he were not such a fairly nice person.
I barely remember that issue. I think Clark Carbaker drew that one. He came back to draw that one. I think I remember that because I always loved his art, and he was always incapable of handling not even a monthly schedule. He was incapable of handling a quarterly schedule. But I always loved it when he got an opportunity to draw the book. So I remember him drawing that issue, I think. But I don't remember too many details of the issue itself. I'm sure that if I did any kind of a superhero-oriented crossover in Nomad, which I know I did a couple times, it was always with the intention of trying to goose the sales just enough that they would allow it to continue to be published.
I remember the main thing was when Gambit, he charged up Nomad's overcoat, and I was thinking that's like the biggest dick move of all.
Yeah, okay, I do remember him doing that. Yeah, there's always the things you want your hero to do that they can't do because they're supposed to be heroes. So when you get a chance to do doppelganger stories or dark personality stories, that's your chance, usually the writer, to have the hero get away with doing dick things that he normally wouldn't be able to get away with.
Just staying on Gambit, I was reading the series you did from 2000 with Gambit in late 99. You seem to have a real affinity for the character. More so, Gambit's always been popular, but you always got a feeling with a lot of writers, they seem kind of snobby toward him, like they didn't like him for whatever reason, but you really dug in and got a lot out of that character.
I always liked the character's potential more than a lot of the things that were done with the character. And when I like the character's powers and I like the character's backstories, I actually like the Thieves Guild and all that stuff. When a character has potential, I really tend to like the opportunity to realize that potential. I'm a big fan of the underdog. I always have been. That's probably why I wasn't a very good X-Men writer, but I was a fantastic New Warriors writer. I like the underdog, and to me, Gambit was always a bit of an underdog. So I enjoyed doing that. I also enjoyed working with Steve a lot, Steve Skroesch, who's a fantastic artist and a fantastic storyteller. So he really made me, you know, focus and pay attention because his storytelling was several levels above a lot of other people's storytelling at the time. So it really, it's good as a writer because it really makes you kind of sit up a little bit, straighten your back out, and really give it your all.
You also really expanded upon the Thieves Guild and the Assassins Guild more so than most people, because it always seemed for a long time it was kind of abstract concept more so than an actual thing, but you really dug in and got a lot out of it.
Yeah, and I think the reason it was an abstract concept is because it was introduced in his limited series. And he never had a monthly series back in the 90s, so it was always a series of limited series. And it's a little hard to flesh kind of deep concepts like that that have a lot of history behind them and a lot of local flair and environment, like New Orleans, behind them. and do that successfully in a miniseries. Because when you're juggling a plot structure for a miniseries, you got several things you got to focus on. So expanding backstory on secondary or tertiary characters is generally something you don't have a lot of room for. Conversely, you do have a lot of room for that in a monthly book, because you can do subplots and you can do entire story arcs that revolve around a subject or one aspect of your character's life. So with Gambit, I could do an X-Men related story, and then the next month I could do a Thieves Guild related story, and it all worked just fine, and I got to expand his personality and context to the X-Men 1 month, and I got to expand the aspects of the Thieves Guild and his interactions with them the next month. And it works a lot better. And so I always liked Howard Mackey and Lee Weeks' concepts for the Thieves Guild and the Assassin's Guild, and I don't think it ever got fair play in the X-Men books. I was actually writing a Gambit book, a prose novel, for Byron Price's company back in the early 90s when they were doing all of those Marvel books. I got like three quarters of the way done before Marvel pulled the contract from Byron Price and they stopped publishing them. But that book was actually going to flesh out all kinds of stuff about Gambit's past, his childhood, his teenage years. It was kind of a story that went back and forth between the present day and the past. I think that it really would have been something that Gambit fans might have enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, well, I'm sad that it didn't happen. One of the villains you also used, and this guy had been maybe a D-lister as far as an X-Men villain, is the Executioner. I only remember him from the action figures. But you really turned him in.
Yeah, he appeared, Scott LaBelle created him. He appeared in an annual, a run of annuals where we were creating new villains for everybody. I don't remember why I used him in Gambit, other than he was available and he was interesting and he had a reason to not like Gambit, I think, at the time. And again, it's the chance to build a character over the course of multiple issues, as opposed to having to do something with him in just one. I do remember, I got a really bad memory for the stuff I did, especially, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But I do remember that we did a couple focus issues on him and got a really good chance to flesh him out a lot. And I liked him. I thought he was an interesting character as a result of the things we did, you know. So that was good. And the response to him was very, very positive by the readers who really enjoyed the opportunity to see this guy get developed.
Now, you created the pig for the series, didn't you?
Actually, that was Steve created the pig. That was a character that Steve really wanted to do. So almost everything about him, the backstory, the look, everything was something that Steve created.
How much would you try to work with the artist as far as plotting on the book?
It depends on the artist. Some have no interest in it. Some have an interest, but they don't have any ability to do it. And Steve had an interest and an ability. Plus, he's the kind of artist. Kevin McGuire is another one. Their storytelling is so excellent. Their ability to move the camera is so strong. Their ability to choreograph action sequences is so strong that 9 times out of 10, they change whatever you plotted in terms of the choreography of fight sequences and things like that, and even the pacing of certain scenes. Like, you write a 2-page scene and they turn it into a 1-page scene because they buy extra page of action, or vice versa. Most artists who do that tend to do it for the wrong reasons and do it the wrong way. But some artists, like Steve, like Kevin McGuire that I've worked with, their choices are almost always right and accurate. They know they can tell this 2-page scene in 1 page, and they know that if they buy an extra page of action, they'll be able to do some phenomenally cool stuff with it. So I gave Steve a lot of rope and gave him a lot of leeway to make changes to the plots I was giving him. Take into account, back then, that was before Marvel was doing almost everything as a full script, so I would do a plot, and then Steve would draw it, and then I would dialogue the pages. So he had a lot of liberty to do stuff. And 99% of the time he made really, really good choices.
Just want to make sure I get into this before, because I'd kick my own ass, but the other work that you're really known for, at least among me and a few friends of mine, was Thunderbolts. Do you remember how you got that book, and did you know what you wanted to do with it from the start?
I'm trying to remember how. I got a call from Tom Brevoort, who told me that Kurt was going to be leaving Thunderbolts, and they all agreed, Kurt agreed too, that I would be a good choice for it because I knew Marvel continuity and I could write a team book and blah, blah, blah. And I had not read, I don't think at that time I had an opportunity to read a lot of the issues of Thunderbolts because I had not been on Marvel's comp list, so I wasn't getting the books every month, which is the best way for me to catch up. As opposed, I'm not going to go out to the store and buy every single book a publisher puts out. So I basically caught up. They sent me copies, or I got copies, and I caught up on the book, and had a few months lead time, you know, to be able to plan. I never planned to do anything different than what Kurt was doing because I thought he did an excellent job on that book. I never planned to change the feel and tone of the book. I was going to tell stories, you know, some stories my way, and I was going to do certain things with certain characters that I wanted to do, but I wasn't going to try to remake the book because I liked the book, and the fans liked the book who were reading it, so why would I want to bother remaking it? One of the most interesting aspects of me taking over that book, which I always thought was kind of cute, was that for about 3-4 months after I'd started writing that book, we continued to get letters addressed to Kurt as the writer for the issues I was writing. So fans who would read the book without looking at the credits, for several months there were fans who didn't even know that Kurt wasn't even writing the book anymore. And it wasn't really because I was copying Kurt, because I don't write the same way he does. I don't script the same way he does. But the tone and feel of the book had not changed, and that's basically what they were getting out of it, you know. So I was actually kind of proud of that, to tell you the truth. And I enjoyed working on that book a lot. It wasn't always an easy job because I would box myself into a corner by trying to juggle too many subplots and trying to do too much with too many characters. But I always liked the book tremendously. I liked the characters tremendously. I liked the message of the book tremendously, which is even the worst people can have an opportunity to try to find a way to redeem themselves. They may not succeed, but as opposed to what Yoda said, sometimes trying is as important as doing, you know, especially in the case of these guys. So in that regard, I enjoyed writing the book tremendously. I really did. I got fired from it twice, and I came back to it two times. So, you know, I must have liked it because rarely do I ever come back to a book that if I've been fired from or I quit.
Okay. One of the characters you used a lot was Charcoal, who was actually the villain in the Wizard Create a Character Contest. What made you decide to actually keep him on the team?
I think that was already in play by the time I got there. I think Kurt had already started that whole thing. I didn't introduce the character. He got introduced during Kurt's run.
Right.
And they were staying in that Colorado town where Charlie lived, so I was just maintaining and continuing the ongoing stories and putting my own spin on them, but I wasn't ignoring what was happening before that. So one of the things that was happening was Charlie. The other thing I planned to do with Charlie, and one of the reasons that he was there, is because he was going to be the opposite tone of the theme, where this was a book about villains trying to redeem themselves and some succeeding and some failing. Charlie's path, his arc, was going to be about a young person who becomes a villain. The goal for me with him was always to make him, to turn him into a villain. So here he is surrounded by these bad guys who are trying to become good guys, and he starts as a good guy who ends up trying to become a bad guy. And there were all kinds of complications with the character. You know, when I killed him off, that was part of the storyline plan all along, and I was going to bring him back, and part of the game plan with him was that every time he got killed off or broke or blown up or broken apart into little briquettes, by the time he reformed himself, there was little things wrong with him. His brain was a little screwed up, explaining how, little by little, he was going to descend into becoming a villain, you know, because this was happening to him. So my game plan all along when I got rid of him the first time was to bring him back. But then there were legal issues happening between Marvel and the winner in that contest, which I to this day I never really got involved in any of it at all. I just know that they were claiming that they, you know, they were owed, you know, gajillions of dollars for the creation of Charcoal, who was setting the licensing world by storm. Clearly, everybody in the world was getting those Charcoal bed sheets to put on their kids' beds. It was making so much money for Marvel. Marvel just said, you know what, we're not going to bother bringing Charcoal back. And I said, can I bring Charlie back? And they said, yeah, you can, but, you know, you were going to wait a while anyway, so let's just wait. And I said, okay, fine. And then I never got around to doing it because it wasn't important enough anymore.
Yeah, I was telling that story to my friend Neil, my co-host, and I told him, Joe, I said, those guys are doing it all wrong. You stay quiet and wait for Marvel to do a movie with him as a background character. Then you get the lawyer.
Yeah, that's the goal. You wait until the Avengers are Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, and Charcoal. That's what you wait for. And they didn't play it right. They should have played it a lot smarter than that.
Now, later, they actually you ended up using the create a character contest from the 1972 issue of Foom.
Yeah, and very few people on the planet Earth would probably do that, I think. And there's a twisted part of me that's actually really happy that I'm one of them. There's a backstory to that, too, though, because my brother entered that contest and had his entry published. I entered that contest, too, but I didn't have my entry published because I was younger, so my character and my art must have sucked really bad. But he got his character published in the different entries they were showing. He created and submitted a character called Novatan. So I had those Foom issues. I have the first four issues of Foom because my brother joined the club. So I knew about that. I knew that they had named him the winner. I knew that they had talked about him being on the X-Men, and I knew that nothing ever happened with it. What I don't remember now, and it's kind of sad because it was less than 10 years ago, wasn't it? I don't remember whether the idea to do that was mine or whether the idea to do that was Tom's. I think it was mine. I just don't remember. I thought it was really, it was a very thunderbolt-y thing to do is what it amounts to, you know? To come up with a major story arc, a major mystery that maybe 10 people on the planet are going to be able to guess. And I did put the clues in there. I put clues throughout a bunch of issues. And actually somebody did guess it at one point, which I thought was great. We didn't know if anybody would. So to tell you the truth, it was a lot of fun to do that.
Okay. Yeah. I wish I had more time, but they kind of limit us here. I'm gonna hit this. The biggest thing I think you did on Thunderbolts was you actually, and this, I thought this took a lot of balls, that you actually try to redeem Zemo.
You know, I got to tell you the truth. If I weren't writing a book that had Zemo in it, I wouldn't have cared enough about the character because I never thought he was a good enough character. But I was writing a book with Zemo in it, and Kurt had done some interesting things with him. But I wanted to do more, and I think I did do more with him. I really am proud of what I did with him, and as in all things comics, you're disappointed when what you do gets ignored by the creators after you or gets changed by the creators after you, especially if you think you spent a lot of time doing something that counts with a character. And I do think I did a lot of things that count with Zemo, and I was really happy with what I did because I never didn't make him a villain. but I gave him such unique and interesting motivations that you could call into question every single thing he said and every decision he made and wonder whether he's a bad guy or trying to be a good guy. And that was a lot of fun to do that. It was a fun character to write, and I really did enjoy getting a chance to write him over multiple years to get a chance to develop him in a way that he never really had a chance to be developed before.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, you know, because I had GM DeMattis, or I can't pronounce his name at all, but I had him on a few months ago, you know, and he did the initial Zemo arc, and when you read that, it's interesting how you'll notice that Zemo never thinks of himself as a bad guy.
The good thing about Marvel is that many of the bad guys don't think of themselves as bad guys. I mean, the good thing in Marvel is that you get characters that are Machiavellian manipulators like Green Goblin, or you get characters that are insecure and angry about their lot in life like Dr. Octopus, or you get a king like Dr. Doom, you know? And I think that's really, really interesting. A lot of DC's villains were always a lot more black and white. They were bad guys, and they knew they were bad guys. The thing that was always more interesting about Marvel's characters is that they always walked a very fine line between being what you thought they were expected to be, which is a bad guy, and being what they thought they expected to be. And that's where the real good writing opportunities happen. And then quite frankly, that's why Marvel's characters have always been in many ways more interesting, more conflicted, and more dramatic than DC's characters.
Now you mentioned you went back to the Warriors, which I know I've read that run a ton of times because I find it over the years. But also in the Nova solo book, I was wondering, are you the first person to really define what the Nova Corps was? Because I've read his previous appearances, and the Nova Corps always seemed kind of a vague concept. Like in the 70s, it seemed like it was a couple of different heroes, but they had different powers. Were you the first one to make it a more uniform concept?
I think I might have been. I think Marv might have done some more fleshing out of the concept in Fantastic Four. Because Nova appeared in a bunch of Fantastic Four issues. I don't have all of them. I have a few of them, and I didn't read all of them, but he may have done a little bit more, figuring it out. I think that anything I did with the Nova Corps was really a result of Mark Renwald talking to me about how to try to develop a Green Lantern Corps version for the Marvel Universe. Because Green Lantern was always Mark's favorite character, to me, I think it was just a matter of this existed in the Marvel Universe, and it really is an analogy or an analogous to the Green Lantern Corps. Why not take advantage of that and try to develop it and build it more? And again, also, it's like I talked to you about the opportunity to flesh concepts out that have a little bit of depth, background, and history to them is easier to do in a solo monthly title for a character than it is when Nova appears in the monthly book of New Warriors, you know?
Okay, and again, I'm sorry if I'm hopping around. I'm trying to hit as many things as I can.
No problem.
In Nomad, you did the story where it went back on his past life, the Dr. Faustus story arc. What I was wondering is, were you ever tempted to try to bring back the 1950s Captain America?
No, not really, no, to tell you the truth. For someone who is too well known for reviving dead characters in ridiculously convoluted ways, the answer is no. That's one that I did not plan or have an interest in bringing back. It could be because I was such a fan of Steve Englehart's story at the time. Such a fan of that story. It blew my mind when I was like 14, 15 years old. I loved it. But I thought it was a little too obvious to do to Nomad now. I had more than enough stories that I could tell of the character that did not involve needing to dredge that part of him up.
I have an unhealthy love of the 50s Captain America. I don't even know why exactly beyond loving the initial stories, but for like I think a few years ago Marvel brought back the 50s Captain America, and I actually plunked down $4 for an issue of a book I don't read regularly.
Did they really bring him back? They brought back the 50s Captain America?
I believe so. Yeah, they brought him back somehow. He was fighting the Bucky Cap, and that's the main thing I remember about the issue was that he was kind of just kicking the crap out of Bucky.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't need to. I mean, if another writer decides they want to do it and they got a good story to tell, I didn't agree that they brought back Bucky, but clearly, you know, Ed Brubaker had a story he wanted to tell, and he did tell it, and he did a good job telling it, but. I was of the generation that was told and believed that three characters stay dead. That's Uncle Ben, Captain Marvel, and Bucky. And apparently they brought back two of those characters. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, you know, I was going to mention this about the baby Bucky in Nomad. It's funny, you know, I read so many things in comics with all these cosmic concepts, and one thing I kept thinking was, there is no way that baby's keeping that mask on.
The mask, no, she used a little spirit gum, and it stayed on real fine, no problem at all. It was part of her costume. You gotta understand that there was unstable molecules in that mask. That's why it was able to stay on.
I was just like, I have a little one-year-old. She was ripping off her, we tried to put a little headband on her head.
Oh, yeah, forget it. No. Yeah, it's like trying to put clothes on a dog. Forget about it. I know. My kids are older now, but I certainly remember what it was like back then. But a real quick story about Bucky in Nomad. I had no plans ever at all to have him walk around with a baby on his back, okay? When I finished that limited series, that was never my intention. James Fry, the artist, is the one who decided to put her in a little baby Bucky costume. And when he did that, we all felt that it was too good an opportunity to waste, that this psychopath would be walking around with a one-year-old baby on his back who had a replica costume of what he wore when he was a teenager. You know, that happened completely unexpectedly out of the blue, and it was worth doing. It was fun to do because it really helped the character stand apart. In a sick way, you know?
Yeah, I got to the issue where the mom came and took the baby back, and she kicked this guy's face through a glass case, and I'm thinking, you know, it seems to me like, you know, they could have, that's one of those situations that probably could have been talked out if both parties weren't in psychos.
I honestly don't even remember the issue where she came back. I know I remember bringing her back. I know I remember her training to be able to get the baby back. And I remember that Nomad gave the baby away, but that was because we knew the end was coming. I knew that the book was going to be canceled with 25 quite a ways in advance. I was going to quit with 25 originally, and then they told me the book was going to be canceled, so that was fine for me because I had an opportunity to tell the story. And we realized that, you know, one of the things we got to do is have him not keep the baby after, you know, the book gets canceled, because I knew that I was going to do a pseudo-death with him, because my hope was that no one would touch the character ever again. I really didn't want anyone else writing him. I can't say that about any other Marvel character I've ever written, but he was one that I wanted no one to ever write again. So my hope was that I was going to end the book in a way that nobody would have bothered, you know, and nobody did. Nobody touched him for a very, very long time, you know?
One last thing, because again, they kind of cut us off after a certain point. When you were editor of Acclaim Comics, do you think that running all of those books and trying to keep a coherent universe, do you think that helped you as a writer?
No, not one way or another. No. I always was very as far as writing in a shared sandbox, I was always very comfortable doing that, and I think I was very good at it. I think I'm very good at working with other writers and other editors to figure things out. I think I'm very unselfish about my own work, as opposed to other writers that I've worked with who are ridiculously, immaturely selfish. I always saw the forest for the trees, and most other writers look at their own tree only. But they piss on everybody else's tree. So no, being an editor in chief didn't do that for me. What it really did is help teach me a lot more about business and about how to handle and manage, personnel, and taught me a lot more about contracts, all kinds of other stuff, but not really anything necessarily about my own writing.
Neil, how much time do we have left, do you think?